Good evening, Cody Stowe.
Good evening, Cody Stowe. I'm the only one here so far. Hi, Hannah. He was here. I guess he'll be back in just a few minutes.
I am back.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's all right. Who else came?
Hannah.
How are you?
I'm fine, thank you.
Esther, I know you have a couple of questions from last week, so I assume you're ready to answer those. If not, you need to review them again.
I know one had to do with Hala, and I guess my question is Hala meaning darkness. Is that correct?
Hala doesn't mean darkness, no.
No. Oh, can you explain the significance of why we eat it on Shabbat?
Hana, do you want to answer that? You're probably more familiar with Hala than myself.
Well, the mitzvah is to remember and to guard the Shabbat. And one of the mitzvot is to, we say bake challah, but it's really to take challah, which means when you bake challah, that you take a portion and set it aside. And you burn it. And it's disposed of. It's too holy to be thrown to the birds. It's too holy for anybody to eat. And it was the mitzvah when the children of Israel entered the land. But the rabbis felt that, or the sages felt that we should, even in exile, do it. Do that particular mitzvah, and especially incumbent upon women who have three mitzvot. And what I find is that most women do everything else, but, and I even found it to be true in Israel, that I only knew of one person who actually baked challah, because it's baked in Israel, they buy their challah. Which is a little disappointing because Pirkei Avot tells us that a cause and effect of not tithing and the taking of challah is considered belonging to that tithing, that drought and famine arises. But we mainly eat challah on Shabbat. And in remembrance of the manna that fell, that God provided the children of Israel during the wilderness, and because there's a promise, I think it's in Parsha Emor, that a blessing rests upon the house where challah is taken. I'm trying to think if there's anything else.
Because there's one more thing that's a little deeper that you just a couple of things.
Okay. Also, I think it's not very well known, thanks to Hanok's teachings, that the first piece that's cut is, and I have to watch how I say this to certain people, if you say that it's given to the Satan, they go into a little, you know, they don't like that. So I usually have, and that's in order to give the Satan his share. So with those who aren't studying Kabbalah, I usually have to say that it's a piece that we set aside in thanksgiving to Hashem for creating the negative system so that we would have free will. And
that's a good explanation.
You know, depending on the group, but those that study Kabbalah or maybe have a little bit more knowledge than, you know, if you say you're giving something over to the Satan, you know, they just...
I don't think they will take that too well. Is there a significance in the eggs in it? Because I know, as opposed to other breads, challah has eggs in it. And so is that significant to anything? I mean, it is, but to what significance?
Well, it does add nutrition. It also, I think at one time, was kind of considered that it gave the bread a yellow look. But when I studied it a long time ago, I found, you know, I felt like it was really whole wheat that was used, not the all-purpose flour that we see in the markets today. But,
and is the three mitzvot baking it and burning the one piece and...
The three mitzvot that are incumbent upon women... is keeping a kosher home. It's the laws of Nidah and the baking or the taking of challah. I really like, you said baking challah, but actually the mitzvot is taking that piece and setting it aside with the blessing. And you have to bake a certain amount of flour or you're not to say the blessing. And I, the way I figured it out, because there were several ways on different sources as to, you know, sometimes they'd use metric measures, sometimes they'd use cups, sometimes they'd use pounds, but it averaged out to be 10 cups of flour before, if you're using 10 cups of flour, then you would say the blessing when you separate that piece. Normally, I separate the pieces. I do make sure that I bake about four. I have two bread machines, and so I make enough dough that I'm able to take a portion from each batch, roll it up in a little ball about the size of an olive, and I put them in a plastic bag and put it in the freezer. And then I have a glass top electric stove. We don't have gas out in the area that I live, so I didn't have a choice. So I take those little balls out of the plastic bag that's in the freezer on a day that I have not baked challah, and wrap it in a piece of foil, and then I say the blessing. There's a particular blessing. It ends with La Hafrish Challah. And I say, this is challah, and put it in the oven in 400 degrees for about 15 or 20 minutes, and then politely put it into the garbage can when I finish.
Oh, wow. Thank you.
I do have a PowerPoint. I haven't given the workshop in almost 2 years, so, and you know how when you do things kind of routinely, it's a wonderful time that you can pray for people while you're braiding and all. And some,
right.
I like using the bread machine because it's not as messy. And then while the dough is being prepared, you can do other things in the house. You know. But, and it just happened, another friend and I, we were trying to see if a PowerPoint would go through in by email or if it was too large. And I did send the PowerPoint, so I know it works. But anyway, there's been another request, you know, to have another workshop. But I haven't taken out my materials to begin to rework them. So, okay, I'm sure I forgot something. I know it's helped me.
Well, not only did you forget something, but there's a few, not errors, but misconceptions that I need to clarify.
Okay.
So let's start with the what you forgot is that the shoresh, the root of the word challah, is milchama, which means war. And we eat challah because we have to fight a war. And that is the war against the desire to receive for oneself alone. And the reason that you were taught to use wheat rather than the white flour, wheat is the is ita in Hebrew, which is one of the seven species of Israel, but it's also one of the fruits. When people speak of the sin of Adam and Chava being eating of the apple, there's actually seven, there's a disagreement as to what the fruit was. And one of them was the wheat. And chita, as we study in about Pesach, and the chametz, the ego involvement, which is what we're fighting, which is what the war is against the desire to receive for oneself alone. Chita is cognate. It sounds like the word chet, which is sin. So it's all tied into that. So that's what Chana forgot to mention, and I know we've spoken about it briefly a couple of times, but it's also easily forgotten because it's so contrary to this concept of shalom or Shabbat shalom, the peace of the Sabbath. But the real meaning of shalom is really shalem, completion. The Sabbath is the completion. And that's what, all of that is why we eat challah. The question you asked about the egg, we add egg to challah because an egg represents givurah, judgment. And by baking the egg, just like we do the roasted egg in the Seder plate, we are sweetening the judgment when we roast it, when we bake it. That's why we add the egg.
I did not know that. Now, the other point you made, I usually bring that out at Tu B'Shvat, but I don't think I brought it out in my workshop. So I knew it, but for some reason, it goes more along with Tu B'Shvat. But I'll remember that and include it next time.
And that's what Torah is all about, is every year we read the Torah the same thing over again, but we remember and we relearn and we change. And that's all, that's what you've just expressed. Now, the other thing I wanted to mention, as I said, it's not a mistake, but I think it's important to the students. Chana's training is very traditional Orthodox. That's not to say that she still practices that way, and I'm not criticizing one way or the other, and Chana knows that.
I know.
But I want to clarify that your training is very traditionally Orthodox.
But nobody turned me in hall, believe me. That was purely my own working. I can't tell you how many batches of dough got thrown in the garbage until I learned. I mean, that was way back in, you know, early 80s. And
when there wasn't, anybody to help you learn these things.
No, on the internet.
The male rabbis never cooked challah.
Mm-hmm.
The other idea of the challah, what Chana is doing is by roasting the challah, burning the challah, it's traditionally the challah was given to the high priest or to the priests. And then they would utilize it to bake the showbread, the 12 loaves that would go in onto the table and on Shabbat. And then the next Shabbat, it was still warm, and that's what they ate. So there's a whole tradition associated with the temple and with challah and all of that. But the real understanding, the deep understanding, is that you when you say the blessing on the challah, your kavanah is that you're fighting a war against the desire to receive for oneself alone.
Thank you.
And was there something else as you were going through it that I... Well, it'll come another time.
Well, it's kind of funny, but everybody loves challah. And, you know, when you take the cover off of the challah and, you know, everybody's, ooh, you know. And then comes Passover and you take the cover off the matzah and everybody just stares. And it's such a difference. And yet, both are so important that it's kind of amusing to watch the look on on your guest's face.
Yes.
When they go from, the challah to the matzah. And
we usually
have matzah left. And so normally I haven't been able to bring everything back in and the chametz back into the house if I have it out. And so we normally go with eating Passover foods probably another week. And so when the challah does come back around, it's almost like you miss the matzah. So it's kind of strange, the emotions that your guests go through, you know, which are mostly family and friends for me that come for Shabbat. It's like they go through a transition, you know, they miss the challah, and then all of a sudden you're eating matzah for quite a while, several weeks, and maybe beyond that week, because you don't have time to make the challah back again before you bring, I know for me it takes me sometimes almost a week to get my kitchen back after Passover. And then it's almost that you miss the matzah. So you go through a transition.
As you were talking, and I remembered a couple of the things I wanted to mention. One, I wanted to stress that while the people in the land of Israel may buy their challah instead of cooking it or baking it, the bakers who bake that challah that they sell in the stores are taking the challah. Otherwise, it wouldn't be kosher. And it's much easier to do so in the sense of the large amount, you know, because as you said, 10 cups of flour, it's a lot of bread. And so smaller families, you know, that are starting out, it's difficult. The other aspect that I wanted to mention You said that the three positive mitzvot for women are the to keep a kosher home. That's not a mitzvah. It's not part of the list of mitzvot. The one you left off, which is a positive mitzvah, is lighting the candles. Yes, it is incumbent on a woman who is a child of Israel to keep a kosher home. It is incumbent on the woman who is in the traditional roles of raising the children to teach the children to be observant, to be aware of Hashem, and to decide and choose to keep the mitzvot. But the actual physical manifestation, which is the three mitzvot, one is to light the candles for Shabbat and holidays. Two is to keep family purity, which is the laws of Nidah. And the third one is
is the challah.
Is to bake the challah, that's correct. But it's really to teach and to fight against the desire to receive for oneself alone, because if you start even with Chava, why did Satan infiltrate Chava's consciousness rather than going directly to Adam? Why did he go to the woman? Why do women tend to be more quote-unquote spiritual in our generation than the men? If you look on our call, even last night, there was only one male student on the Rosh Chodesh event. Everyone else were women. Why is that? And the understanding is that the women, being Malchut, are more connected, more easily connected to the negative system, unless they choose to connect to Bina, to the mother, to the energy store, to being closer to God. And then they will be, you know, then Adam is the one who would be attracted and be vulnerable to the negative system. So now that I have confused people and, you know, shown my chauvinism, are there any other questions?
I'd only say that when, I guess, I don't remember if I was taught that way or if it was just my own assumption, but in keeping a kosher home didn't just mean keeping kosher. You know, it meant lighting the candles. You know, it meant a lot of different things.
Keeping a kosher home is incumbent, but it is not the mitzvah. It's the same idea that it's incumbent on the men to take a mikveh every 3 days, because we need to cleanse ourselves from the impurity of the world. But it isn't a mitzvah for us to go into the mikveh. It's incumbent on us. If we don't do it, it's very difficult to keep the mitzvot. But it's not a mitzvah for a man. It's not a mitzvah for a woman to get married. And yet, if she decides not to get married, what is her partner going to do? It's a mitzvah for him, but she has to agree. So there's this duality within the concepts of keeping the mitzvot, where there are some things that by tradition we do, by custom we do, but they're not harsh, hard and fast mitzvot. Maimonides made a list of the mitzvot, all 613. 100 years later, Nachmanides said, no, it's not quite correct, and he made some changes. His list is slightly different than Maimonides. What are the 613 mitzvot? There is this quote-unquote confusion. But the reality in our generation, we can't do them in any way. We can only do approximately 200 of them. And the other thing I wanted to say, a woman is obligated to do three positive mitzvot, as we've discussed. But she is also obligated to keep the 365 negative mitzvot. And frequently people are not told that, because positive mitzvot means you must do an action. Negative mitzvot means it's recommended to not do an action. And the reason that is given for why a woman is not obligated to the other positive mitzvot is they're time sensitive. They're to be done at a certain time. And since they need to be done at a certain time, and the priority for a woman is to manage the education of children, the care and feeding and the education of children, and much more associated with children, that it would put her in conflict. But still, a woman is obligated to pray at least once a day. But it doesn't specify which of the three prayers that she needs to do, because she has the responsibility of the children, and they take priority as to the timing of the day. So sometimes women will pray in the morning, and sometimes in the evening, and sometimes in the afternoon. But it's all related to, yes, she has the obligation to pray, but we don't mention that as one of the three positive mitzvot. And as when I read that halakha, and I brought it to one of my Kabbalah teachers, and I said, you know, a woman's obligated to pray once a day. He said, please make sure you tell my wife, because I'm not about to. That was meant to be a joke, but I assume it wasn't funny.
Well, I know when I have a friend who very, very Israeli. She got a good speak English. And years ago when she came, she married someone from Lake Charles. And when she came to Lake Charles to meet her father-in-law for the first time, I asked her to show me at that time, you know, about the prayer book and what was encumbered upon a woman. And she showed me the Imhot, the Havdalah. She said, if we at least said the Hamavdil, you know, mm-hmm. So she said, you know, that was, you know, if time was a real element for you. And that was what, you know, what I learned a long time ago. So
I understand.
So,
Amy, do you remember what the second question you wanted to ask?
Yeah. Yes. Your morning prayers, are they supposed to be done, like, start at sunrise? Are you supposed to be finished before sunrise? The timing, what is it, like, the timing of the morning prayers? And one of the reasons I'm asking is because on Sunday when we had our talk, and he told me to do my Zohar after midnight, and I've been since Sunday, and I've been doing that, and I can see tremendous changes.
When is morning prayers?
Yes.
Well, there's a few aspects of morning prayers. So most, I'm going to give you an example of the town of Lakewood, New Jersey, which has a tremendous amount of observant Jews.
Orthodox.
Yes.
Like half of my family's from there. So
okay.
I know Hana isn't familiar with it, but I am.
Okay, but let me describe it to the other students, please. So this community consists of about 20 or 30,000 observant families, or people rather than families, but obviously they're connected in families. There's Sephardic, there's Ashkenazi, there's Mizrahi. They're all aspects of observance is expressed. And they literally have what they refer to as minion factories, where from the moment that you can say the morning prayer, which I'll go into in a minute, from that moment on, there's constant minions until 12 o'clock in the morning, till noon. So they one right after the other. They have many rooms. They have many minions going on. And it's literally a factory of minions is the way they describe it. Now, within those halachot, there are times that the Shema should be said. And at the same time, there's a statement that you could say the Shema later than that. And there's this explanation that if you say it before the right, the limited time, there's one level of energy. And if you say it after, you still receive the merit of saying the Shema for that prayer, but you don't get as exactly the same amount of energy. Now, with that being said, when we speak of the morning prayers or the afternoon prayers or the evening prayers, we are talking about the Amidah. We're not talking about the Shema that leads up to the Amidah. We're not talking about other prayers or psalms that we will say leading up to or after the Amidah. Prayer in the traditional Orthodox Judaism means the Amidah. There is a morning minion called Netz, and it refers to that exact moment when the sun crests the horizon. It's not that the sun has risen, but the top tip of the sun can now be seen at the horizon. That is Netz. That is the moment of Netz. And in the first minion of the day, Netz is when the Amidah starts. And it is said that a man is supposed to say the prayer, meaning the Amidah, with a minion. But if he doesn't, and he says it at Netz, it's as if he said it with a minion. Now, what is that all about? And the metaphorical story that I was told that explains the difference between saying the Amidah in a minyan or at other times than the Netz moment is like you went to the bank and you cashed a check for $100 and you took your own money out of the bank in your pocket as $100 cash. But if you were saying the Amidah at Netz at that moment, that moment of the reduction or the elimination of the Gibur Ad energy from the earth because that's what that cresting of the sun represents. It would be like you walked into the bank and the teller ushered you into the bank vault and said, take what you want. That's the difference in energy that you would receive if you are able to be up at that moment and saying the Amida. And the best aspect is to join a Netz minion, which is a minion that is praying the Amida at that moment of Netz. And if you've ever experienced it, you'll understand the difference in what is the energy. So I hope that answered your question.
Yes, thank you very much. I appreciate that.
There's one other question you asked me. Do you remember what it is?
I remember what it is.
About the 72 names.
Yes. I remember the numbers you had given us, but can you tell us again, the 72 names, how many there are for each week and how we find them?
There are many different ways to, I don't want to say separate or categorize the 72 names and relate them to specific days or energies or weeks. So I'll just give you a few of them, because there literally are many different ways. The way that you're seeing it on my emails is each month has 30 days. Some months have 29 days, but essentially there's 30 days in a month, which means that there are 6 5-day cycles. And so there are 6 72 names associated with each month. And each of the 6 has a connection to 5 days in that month. So Rosh Chodesh to day 5 gets a name. The 6th of the month to the 10th of the month gets a name. The 11th of the month to the 15th of the month gets a name. The 16th to the 20th, the 21st to the 25th, and then the 26th to the 30th, or if the month only has 29 days, it goes to 29. That is the way, that's the cycle. And it starts in the first month of the year, which is Nisan. So that's what you're seeing in my emails. So some weeks there will be 3 names. Other weeks there will be 2. There will never be 1 name in a week. Now, another way of categorizing the 72 names is to take the first month, the first name, and connect it to the first month, and then the 13th name, which would connect to that same month. And the 25th name, which would connect to that same month, and so forth. So essentially, you go through the months in a sequence of 12. And therefore, it's a different set of names than the way I've outlined in the emails. But it is 6 names per month. When you are born on a particular day of the month, you're connecting to all of those names, all of the different categories. And if you look at the factors, the mathematical factors of 72, you have 6 times 6 times 2. You have 12 times 6 You know, you have all of these different connections and factorials, and all of that relates to the various 72 names that would be associated to your birth on that particular day, because you have chosen the best astrological moment to come into the world, so that the astrology will push you, impel you towards your tikkun, meaning the astrological influences impel you to a place and a time and a moment where the various souls that you have tikkunim with, corrections with, will be available for you to be given the free choice of what action you will do. And that's where we get the understanding that the astrological influence impel you, but never compel you, because Hashem does not take away free will. Only man tries to take away another man's free will. And that's what we call slavery. And that's what we call force. And unfortunately, that is what has to come out of this world. Or I shouldn't say unfortunately, but that's what the spiritual work is about. That you change yourself, but you don't try to force someone else to change, to do it your way. Because after all, you're right and he's right. But that's not the way we perceive the world according to the Western world's philosophy. It's not that in the Western world, I'm right and you're wrong. In the Torah, I'm right and you're right. And how do we reconcile and respect and love each other? So I'm not sure I've answered your question completely about the 72 names, but there's always a reason why that's the truth for this moment.
Thank you, Fano. Thank you.
You're welcome. Are there any other questions? Kodesh Tov to all. I hope you have a wonderful, wonderful month. Please enjoy the flood.
Kodesh Tov, thank you.
Have a wonderful month, too. Okay. Bye-bye. Good night.
Bye-bye.
Kodesh Tov.
Kodesh Tov.